Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and this session is devoted to the subject of a five-year research project which has been undertaken by the University of Reading in collaboration with the V&A Museum's Theatre Department. It is called Giving Voice to the Nation, the Arts Council of Great Britain and the Development of Theatre and Performance in Britain 1945 to 1995. And it investigates the history and practices of the Arts Council of Great Britain from its beginnings in 1945 to the changes that took place in the mid-1990s. To guide us through this sometimes complex terrain, I'd like to introduce three people who have been instrumental in realising this project. The first is John Bull, Emeritus Professor of Film and Theatre at Reading University and Professor of Drama at the University of Lincoln, and author of New British Political Dramatists and Stage Right. The second is Graham Saunders, Readers in Theatre Studies at Reading, and author of two books on playwright Sarah Kane. And the third is Kate Dorney, who is Senior Curator of Modern and Contemporary Performance at the V&A Museum, and author of The Changing Language of Modern English Drama, as well as joint author with Francis Gray of Played in Britain, Modern Theatre in 100 Plays. Welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello.
Hi.
Could you each start off by saying briefly how you became involved with this project and what your particular area of interest was? Kate.
My first encounter with the Arts Council archive was when I was actually working for a different organisation, and I was doing some interviews trying to find out about how a particular bit of statute had got on the books. And my interviewee said that the Arts Council required theatres to deposit a copy of the script at the British Library. I finally tracked down the Arts Council archive at being at the V&A, and when I came to look through this a really big selection of material, I realised it was a real treasure trove of information and it wasn't very widely accessible. And then when I came to work at the V&A, I was looking around for people to do a project on, and I knew John and I really admired John and Graham's work, so we put together a bid to the Arts Council to look at the impact of the Arts Council's work on policy and practice.
And you got the funding from the actual Arts Council?
No, we got it from the Arts and Humanities Research Council.
Right, John.
As Kate says, I mean, I'd known her for a while, and I suppose also the proximity of Reading to London was very good. And I came and looked at the collection and was shocked. It's absolutely huge. It's enormous. It feels like walking around a kind of library version of a football stadium when you get in there. And what was even more amazing was to realise that the vast majority of the material contained in there hadn't been looked at really, essentially, since it had been first put in there, and then to some extent reboxed many years later. And you know, a familiar refrain when you wanted to look at stuff was, "I'm afraid we have to get it cleared first," which means that people had to read through it at the V&A to see. Usually, the people's CVs weren't being compromised and stuff of that sort, but maybe other material as well. So that it was very exciting to suddenly have all this stuff revealed to you and to see a world in which not only did you see all the kind of official materials, but you saw also the internal memos, the pithy and sometimes rather rude notes about clients, about other people within the Arts Council, etc. Sometimes not even knowing whether you were meant to take it seriously. I have on my wall now in my office, I treasure it very much, a photocopy of an internal memo which is addressed, I won't say who the people were, but it says basically, "Oh, so how are we going to respond to Harold Pinter's request that we have tea at 3:15 instead of 3:45? And there's a handwritten note there that says, "Accede to it." And you never know in what spirit that was actually written. And I don't think that's sort of earth-shattering stuff in terms of theatre history, but frequently it is.
Graham, how did you become involved?
Well, as Kate and John said, it was very much Kate getting in contact with John and myself, and putting together a bid for the AHRC, and then also deciding, I suppose, between the three of us, we decided what we were going to look at in terms of the archive, because as John mentions, it's so vast. And we're also it's worth pointing out that we're only looking at the theatre side of the Arts Council. Mm. That, you know, they have a literature panel, they have a music panel, they also look at photography, film, dance. So when we were thinking about what we would look at in the 5 years, we narrowed things down to look at very specific things. So we're looking at new writing, regional theatre, and touring theatre. They're the three main prongs. Mm-hmm. But if you think to yourself, well, there's lots of other areas which of course, we won't have time to look at. Mm-hmm. So what we decided to do is that we also have two PhD students who are also researching on the project. So that each one of us is sort of looking at various areas of the Arts Council. I'm sure John and Kate will mention what they're looking at. So I'm looking, for example, at the moment at touring theatre, particularly small-scale touring theatre companies, the so-called fringe companies and middle-scale touring.
Are those the ones of the 1970s, or do you sort of look at them?
At the moment, I'm looking at the 80s onwards, but this previous work I've done looked at some of the 70s. So I looked, for example, it's a chapter that's forthcoming in a series that Patrick Duggan at Exeter is editing on small-scale touring companies. So I'm looking at Foco Novo,
right.
And their work in the 70s and 80s.
Kate, can you say a bit about how this archive came to the V&A? I mean, you'd think that it's comparatively recent, so why didn't the Arts Council just hold on to it?
So the Arts Council Archive, which as Graham said, covers all the departments of the Arts Council's work and all its administrative affairs, is 26,000 files. So it's about 2 kilometres, 2 linear kilometres, if you laid out all those boxes in a room. So no repository wants to hold on to that kind of level of information. And unusually, the archive was a joint acquisition between what was then the Theatre Museum and the Archive of Art and Design, because the visual arts side of the Arts Council Archive is easily as important as the theatre material. There's also a large collection of music material that people like to come and research. So the archive came here in the mid-90s after the Arts Council had decided that it was going to devolve from being the Arts Council of Great Britain into the nations, and it came with a dowry to do the skeleton cataloguing that John was talking about. So everything is in these kind of very civil service greeny grey boxes that you get and you open up, and it's filed with civil service kind of lethal accuracy. But the big difficulty for researchers is that the Arts Council was a huge organisation and it was continually restructuring. So how that's kind of represented in paper is very, very complicated. So although the catalogue is actually really, really good, if you're used to reading archival catalogues, from a research point of view, it's difficult for people to navigate because it's so huge.
And I'm sorry.
Well, I was also going to explain why John was talking about the closures.
Mm.
When we got the archive, it was ruled by the government legislation of the 30-year rule. Exactly. So anything less than 30 years old was closed.
You anticipate my question.
Sorry.
That's all right.
That's now been superseded by data protection and freedom of information legislation, which means that everything in the archive has to be checked. Somebody in the archive team has to read any request, read through all the files, which might be, I don't know, 200 files, send a summary to the Arts Council and say, are you happy for us to give out this information?
So it's open to the public, but there might be items withdrawn if they're more embarrassing than
yeah.
Harold Pinter saying yes to change it.
And it has to be, it would be closed if it's sensitive personal data. Mm. So maybe a CV, but more likely to be a job appraisal or somebody writing a particularly kind of devastating begging letter saying, please give me some money, my wife's left me, etc., etc.
And one of the problems about dealing with the archive, in addition to the fact that it's so kind of labyrinthine, and you have to test one set of boxes against another set of boxes, and sometimes you find the correspondence kind of threading through various different series, is that actually when you arrive and you've ordered stuff up, and then it says the first three files are not available. Now, I know, we all know, that mostly what that is about people applying for jobs in some kind of way, that they're still around and they're entitled to their privacy and nobody has any problems about that. But sometimes you just don't know. Sometimes you're chasing an Arts Council award to a theatre company that is withdrawn.
Mm.
And suddenly the correspondence stops and you just wonder,
why?
Is there more correspondence?
Yeah.
Am I being denied access to this correspondence? Yeah.
I can answer that question.
No. And what I have to say is that on the whole, as far as one can explore it, it doesn't look as though that really has happened, that the access has been pretty good. But obviously you just never know. And sometimes it's very frustrating. You never quite get to the end of the story.
Yeah. And look, can you just clarify actually for me, Kate? Does this mean that the 30-year rule doesn't apply anymore? Or does it mean that it's within the last 30 years?
No, the 30-year rule no longer applies.
Okay.
So you can make closures under Freedom of Information. You can apply an exemption and say that something is commercially sensitive or, you know, it's not in the public interest for it to be divulged.
And who makes that decision? The VNA?
The archivist in consultation with our Freedom of Information officer. Mm. But what happened before this project started was any time anybody made a request, it had to be done under Freedom of Information, which means there's a 20-day check-in period. So as part of our grant to the Arts and Humanities Research Council, we put in for some money to catalogue all of the material that we wanted to look at and under these broad headings of new writing, regional and touring. And that has all been cleared.
Right.
So now anyone can access that information much more easily, and the cataloguing is more detailed, so you can narrow down what you're looking for by date. But what we can't do is legislate for misfiling or a sudden move to a different department, which can lead to a dead end when you absolutely least expect it.
Right, okay. Graham, could you talk a bit about the aims of the research in general? Why did you just choose, say, three or four areas to look at?
We wanted to sort of choose three areas which we felt we had the widest impact. And I suppose Kate's partly answered one of the main aims of the research in her last response was, is basically to get people into the archive to look at this work. So, for example, if you're thinking about sort of looking at the Arts Council's response to, say, the controversies of a play like Howard Brenton's Short Sharp Shock.
Okay, yeah.
There's correspondence in the Arts Council about, you know, they're faced with all of these, you know, Colonel Blimps from all over the country saying this is an absolute disgrace. It's Airy Neave is being sort of satirised. You know, he's being blown up by the IRA, and you suddenly see what an institution like the Arts Council do to try and defend both the play and their position in funding it.
Yeah.
So, for example, there are series like that. We're not, for example, looking at institutions like the RSC or the National Theatre. There's a huge section on the files on Peter Hall's time at the RSC, the sort of long battle to get the National established on the South Bank. So we're looking at certainly getting people into the archive, and we're hoping that the published work will sort of alert people to the fact they've got all of this repository waiting.
And
also what it, we anticipate the project doing is to sort of add to our knowledge of what we think are well-known stories or myths that have accrued about particular plays, institutions, or companies. But we might want to talk about that later in the project we're doing on British theatre companies. Okay. So yeah, they're the main things.
And it is actually astonishing how few people have used the archive as a resource. So the only published works about the Arts Council have been written by ex-Arts Council staff. And some of them were commissioned by the Arts Council in the first place. Histories of really big companies have tended to not look at the Arts Council papers, so they're following a really received narrative. And when Graham's talking about censorship, we all did some research on censorship early on in the project, and you found that the kind of story you expected was just not true about why people lost their funding. John should talk about his example.
Which was at the time a very contentious moment. Cast the original alternative theatre company in the mid-1960s and 784, lost under pressure of government cuts in spending by the Arts Council, both lost their grants. And John McGrath, who was obviously still alive at that time, was very vociferous in his protests, had printed across the top of the letterhead of 784 a big thing saying censored, big block thing. And there was a very real thought at the time that the political censorship had taken place. And indeed, we have found points, and Graham's mentioned one with the Harold Brenton Short Sharp Shock, the Romans in Britain, that kind of period, when clearly the Arts Council were being put under pressure by various people in the government, in fact, to effectively censor things on the grounds of politics or unsuitability or whatever. In the case of 784, in many ways the jury is still out. The claim was that their work was not as good as it had been, and that therefore they should give way to allow money to be spent on newer companies. But it's very, very hard to exactly tie it down. You read show reports, which were done regularly, of course, and you find good ones, you find bad ones. You read committee meetings, which as you move towards, sorry, committee minutes, as you move more towards the present day, of course, they get more and more circumspect. People are never quite as outspoken.
Why do you think that? Is it because bureaucrats are more aware that all this material will soon be in the public
domain? I don't think that anybody in the period 1945 to certainly the first 10 years had any idea whatever that this material would be kept for anybody's use other than for their own to go back and look. It's rather like watching, I don't know, reading, you know, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, when they, you know, they break into the archives, as it were, to look at them. These are not archives that are intended for outside actors. But I think at some point, in certainly by the 70s, when things were hotting up politically as far as public subsidy is concerned, I think people did start to begin to think about it and to realise that, you know, posterity would be reading these words, yes.
Well, I think it's also worth remembering that the Arts Council is not a monolithic institution. So there, and a lot of the people who were on what were the panels who gave advice to the council were practitioners.
Yes.
So you had to be very careful about what you put in minutes, because it would get back to people. But what,
and this was the system of sort of peer review of funding decisions, is that right?
Well, not exactly, the peer review was usually in terms of the show reports, which were originally done by members of the drama panel and the other panels, but then eventually they asked experts from outside, Kate is indeed performing the role now for Arts Council of England, to write reports, who weren't actually directly on the panel, so they sort of they widened the franchise.
But the panel would give advice.
Yes.
To the council about which decisions they thought they would take, but they didn't have any executive power. And at one point, they mostly resigned in the 80s.
But interesting, those show reports are the advisors to the drama panel. And some of them are from the panel, some of them are outside the panel. The artist never saw they would get the show report, but they wouldn't know who'd written it.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're very interesting is that you see people. So for example, 784.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my theory about 784 is that their peers lost faith in them.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some very well-known names in theatre actually saying this. We're talking about 784 England at the time. This is just not up to muster. Now, as John says, they have an odd. Throughout the 80s, 784, sometimes they do fantastic work.
Mm.
So a play by Peter Cox that they do on the Miners very early on in the decade, One Big Blow, it gets unanimous praise. Mm. Then the next thing they do, for example, something they do a revival of Trees in the Wind, their first ever play. Gets terrible reviews. So you see,
But actually, at the moment, they were about to be forced to bow out. They had one of their most rapturously received things, the play on the Tor Palamontes, which almost without exception has rave reviews from newspapers, show reports, etc., etc. It's almost like, you know, John McGrath giving two fingers to the Arts Council.
I think what's
why put on a play about martyrs?
What's also very clear is that a lot of companies really struggled as they had to become more accountable for their money, and that the Arts Council hated it, and it made it very easy for them to cut people who, you know, got their grant in April and then asked in May if they could have some money for a new van or needed to move offices. And actually, I think that feeds into what Graham's saying, that as money became tighter, your peers would be thinking the same thing. You know, why have you got all this money? There's a great quote from Peter Hall where he says, you know, when someone can't afford a pair of tights in Scunthorpe, it's because everyone at the National is reclining on a bed of cash.
Well, you mentioned 784. That's 7% of
population.
The population, only 84% of the wealth in those days. I mean, heaven knows what it is now. But of course, the rival political theatre companies were making the joke that 7% of the political touring theatre companies were getting 84% of Arts Council wealth.
Absolutely.
Which is a nice one. Graham, would you mind talking a bit about the conferences that you've organised as part of this project?
Well, we've organised altogether four conferences. First conference we looked at the regions. We then also did a side conference, or a symposium, at Kingston that looked at the Cork Report, very well known.
Well, talk about that. What is the Cork Report?
The Cork Report was important. It was the first time the state, it was almost a sort of top down state of Britain's theatre culture.
Mm.
The previous time they'd actually done a theatre survey of this sort of magnitude was 1970.
And the Cork Report was what year?
And it was 89.
Okay.
And what it found was a sort of terrible situation of sort of this parlous state of sort of decrepit regional reps, people making do, a sort of reduction in new writing, a sort of concentration on revivals of sort of old war horses like sort of Priestley's Dangerous Corner and Shakespeare. And what the Cork Report did, it sent out people as diverse as Michael Billington, Diana Rigg, out into the country to take the pulse. And it basically recommended a big injection of money.
Okay.
And interestingly, one of the things it wanted to do to sort of promote new writing, it argued that because television drained, particularly independent television, drained the resources from theatre, that ITV should pay a levy back to via the Arts Council. Some of its recommendations were taken up, others were not taken up. Basically, one of the good things that came out of it was this three-year franchise. So you had a sort of situation a bit like bed blocking, where you had companies who had been around since the 70s, who perhaps started to run out of steam, but they were getting the bulk of the money, and newer companies weren't getting, they were basically on either project funding or they weren't just getting funded at all. So what they said was that if you had been on project funding for 3 years in succession, you would then get revenue funding for 3 years. So it allowed the company to sort of grow, but it also allowed the Arts Council to say, well, hang on a minute, some companies are sort of, are perhaps have run out of steam, particularly when a sort of leading light of a company left. So the three-year funding franchise went on to the early 90s until Black Wednesday, and then funding stopped for that.
What the other two conferences then?
And the other two conferences, we had a big conference at the V&A last summer, which basically sort of brought all the strands together and looked at policy. What is the relationship between arts policy and
sponsorship and patronage?
So we're sort of looking at that. And then the very last conference that we did looked at new writing and policy, arts policy with new writing, how can new writing be promoted? And it sort of it both looked at sort of the Arts Council, but lots of other related things as well. So it was an excuse, if you like, to sort of again take the pulse of what new writing constitutes at the moment.
Correct. And John?
Yeah, I was going to say new writing, is an area that I've been particularly interested in. Is actually quite a good case in point of seeing how the relationship between the Arts Council and its clients operated. Because really what in effect happened from, say, around 65 through up until 70 and then into the 70s was an increasing proliferation of, obviously, of new writing, new groups doing new writing and so on, and a feeling that, that they had, and certainly if you look in the files, that the people who were making decisions on the drama panel, or at least were making recommendations on the drama, were actually very ill-equipped. I mean, they frequently would write letters saying, I really don't think I can talk about this kind of stuff. I don't know anything about it. Thank you very much, Lady So-and-so. So increasingly, there was more representation by those new writers, some of whom, however, decided not to go on the panels because they thought it compromised them. But also, it led to pressure to form new panels, experimental and... remind me, new and experimental theatre, community theatre, new projects theatre, etc. So there was a kind of proliferation of the things. So you can see that the policy was being changed by the pressure coming from the clients. But also you could see that, if you look back in then, that the kind of this almost full-scale war we seem to have embarked upon now between, on one hand, theatre as text, on the other hand, theatre as performance, etc., all the roots of that are to be found in the material from the Arts Council files from the late 50s into the 60s. So you get people writing long screens which they've been commissioned to do on community theatre, on physical theatre. You get groups like the People Show, for instance, wanting to take a very different kind of position, say from Portable Theatre, both of whom were being funded at the time. And you can see all these things beginning to happen. You're getting things back from people who say, this has been sent to the music panel, but really it's not music, it's performance. And they say, well, is it performance or is it music? Or is it in fact dance? Because people move around and it's physical. And so a lot of those kind of areas were being perforce confronted by the overall structure of these advisory panels.
And the art forms always were a bit in advance.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And then you could also tell fashion. There was a time in the 70s when community theatre seemed to be getting more than anybody else. But then people at the Arts Council started to get worried that actually, shouldn't that be being dealt with by the education department? Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything to do with them at all. It was to do with, things to do with education. So, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
Kate, Graham's talked a bit about conferences. Could you talk about the Arts Council seminars that were run as part of this project?
Yeah, as Graham said, at the V&A conference last year, we invited Barbara Matthews, who was then head of theatre, and also James Duser, who was in the research department, to our conference, because we realised that we'd spoken to lots of ex-Arts Council people, but to nobody who was actually working there. And the other thing that becomes really apparent when John's talking about the text versus performance, is pretty much everything that was happening to the Arts Council during the last 4 years, we had seen happen to the Arts Council historically. And the Arts Council England is now so small that it has no institutional memory. It doesn't know about any of these things that had happened. So the whole project team, Graham, John, myself, Jackie Bolton, who was our postdoctoral researcher, Taryn and Tony, our PhD students, all went and gave research presentations to the assembled staff of the Arts Council, talking about the history and the changes in development as they went through. And they were really interested, but I think it's also fair to say that they felt completely detached. It was as if it had happened to somebody else. And talking about the Cork report, that's very timely now that, you know, this report has been done that says that the imbalance of funding between London and the regions is so great. Well, that's something that the Cork report had tried to address, that various other reports had tried to address.
As if we're condemned to repeat history.
Yeah. I think so, and I think maybe that that this new, very, very lean Arts Council is an Arts Council where you can't have any interests outside what the council's business is, in the way that the people who were on the panels or who ran it did. It's a very, very different beast.
But that's one thing that hasn't really been mentioned so far. One of the other strands of the project is that we've brought ex-members of the Arts Council of Great Britain in to interview them. And to sort of
debrief them.
Basically, yes, it's bringing them in from the cold, it is interesting that they had this. One of the things we've noticed about the Arts Council is that if you were an individual who had a real passion for something, so for example, John's mentioned community arts, that there were drama officers, people like Nick Barter, Sean Ead, who were really passionate about theatre and education and community theatre. And they were integral in promoting individual companies, initiatives, and promulgating that and putting their case on the drama panel. Because you also had sort of, you had people on the drama panel, sometimes who were very, and I won't name names, but some people were very well-known figures who were rather dyed in the wool and perhaps didn't appreciate the events after sort of 68. For example, John mentions live art. They were very much the hot potato in the drama, in the drama. People never knew what to do with them. After 73...
Do you mean you would classify and how you would fund it?
Yeah. Art funded them for a period from 73 onwards. Or a group like Complicité were funded by the dance department under MIME. So groups like Trickster and Complicité.
And if you look in the files for a group like Moving Beam, find it sometimes described as a dance group, sometimes as a music group, sometimes as a multimedia group. And obviously, great company they were as well, but obviously they were very adept at changing their skins at appropriate moments, and good luck to them, because that was playing the game. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John, could you just talk a bit about the publication of a series of books?
Yes, obviously one of the things that has come out of this, as well as conference papers, and we've done quite a lot of panels at various conferences, particularly international ones abroad, and individual articles, is that Graham and I are involved in a three-volume project for Methuen, which is it's undergone various titles. I think it was called From Fringe to Mainstream. I'm currently betting for it to be called Against the Stream. I'll tell you why in a minute. But it's basically the history of what was originally known as fringe and alternative theatre groups from 1965 until the present day. The reason for the doubt about the thing is because one of the things that we have really had brought home to us is actually the change from that notion of those early theatre groups, that they were resolutely, in all sorts of different ways, but resolutely against the traditional theatre.
Yeah, it was alternative.
It was alternative, it was fringe, it was community, it was a county culture. As you move into the present era,
you start to find, you know, all those words, mission, and you know, all those kind of institutional, business, evangelistic type things, and that the companies, on the whole, to generalise, see themselves not really as being apart from, but kind of alongside that. So the history itself is very interesting. It tells us a lot about sponsorship. It tells us a lot about the way in which culture is both perceived and received in the country as well. And I think that, you know, a very instructive thing to do right now will be to look at the way in which Punch Drunk, for instance, operate, to see, you know, how they are funded, how they go about actually keeping going, where things come from and so on, and what it is they're trying to achieve. And I think, you know, it's obviously, that's beyond the remit of the project, but not beyond the remit of the third volume, which will certainly include material on Punch Drunk.
Any last thoughts, Kate?
No, I suppose being someone who works in a big organisation, I am quite defensive about the people who worked at the Arts Council, the so-called bureaucrats, because very few of them were bureaucrats, and they actually did a lot of quite skillful advocacy. And for example, the chapter that I've been writing for the books that John and Graham are editing is on the Women's Theatre Group. And you can see at various points where their friendly local drama officer is trying to steer them towards a particular direction that will be guaranteed funding. And you can see them not picking up on the hit because they were still very much in that kind of alternative mode.
Because they wanted to be a collective, and the people from the Arts Council quite rightly wanted them to get charitable status, which meant they had to have a proper constitution, and instead of all six of them signing the letters, somebody had to admit to being in charge.
Idealism versus pragmatism, isn't it?
But later on,
no prizes for guessing what won out.
And their their insistence on devising as a group, and you can, just gentle voices will say, would you like some money for a writer to work with? No, we don't need one.
One of the things we hope that the series will show is that some of these companies were the architects of their own downfall. They really were. They didn't read the signs in the wind, and the Arts Council were doing their best to keep them on course. Okay.
It's a great subject, and it's obviously a big project, but we've run out of time now, so thank you very much, John, Kate and Graham.
Thank you.